It's Friday, December 14, 2012. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The internet has become a major factor of modern life, almost seemingly indispensable to life these days. Many essential services have actually moved onto the internet, and without the internet, it seems very little actually takes place in terms of international commerce, an increasingly large proportion of the American economy. Not to mention the personal communications that take place between individuals and the massive amount of content that passes internationally. That international transmission has become a very sticky issue, especially for autocratic nations that want to restrict free speech and the incredible free access of information that the internet provides. Big news on that score came yesterday in a moment of high drama, where in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, the United States turned down a treaty refusing to sign a revision to the telecommunications treaty between nations and really would have put the internet at the danger of autocratic governments who could have shut down or threatened to shut it down over issues of free speech. The United States made its announcement through Terry Kramer, the head of the U.S. delegation. He said, quote, "It's with a heavy heart that I have to announce that the United States must communicate that it is unable to sign the document in its current form," end quote. That statement "is with a heavy heart" indicates political frustration, not so much a sense of tragedy. The United States was never likely to sign this treaty. Given the fact that the United States considers the internet now to be in a much healthier position in terms of the free flow of information. The free flow of information is exactly what was threatened by this treaty, as international groups in general, and specifically more autocratic nations, wanted to bring the internet under some form of national control. At present, the internet is under the control of no nation, although the United States has a predominant influence, as was even reflected in statements by the Russian delegation, indicating that there's recognition that Americans are the mothers and fathers of the internet. But now that it has become so central to international life, not to mention private individual life, those nations that feel threatened by the open, free flow of ideas on the internet have tried to find some way to bring it under control. Also, we need to note that in an age of increased cybersecurity, terrorism itself is also threatened to appear on the internet. What we're looking at here is a major breakdown in the old order. The old telecommunications treaty began as a treaty about the telegraph back at the end of the 19th century. Telephones and other forms of telegraphic communication during the 20th century were the standard fare of government regulation, but the internet avoids all of that by becoming a thing in itself that is apparently outside that kind of regulatory control. Now, there are concerns about that, of course, and many of the techno-optimists who simply see that free flow of ideas as an unmitigated good thing have to deal with the fact that that free flow includes the flow of much stuff that shouldn't belong anywhere, ranging from pornography and all kinds of incendiary literature to stuff that can only be described as evil in any context. But who should do the filtering? That's the big question. And as George Orwell would warn us in terms of Big Brother, if Big Brother takes on that responsibility, then Big Brother does control the flow of information. And Big Brother can turn off anything he doesn't like. And some governments want that. There was irony in the fact that the conference itself was being held in the United Arab Emirates, an Arab country that believes that the internet is at least partly responsible for the Arab Spring and doesn't want to see a similar kind of outbreak elsewhere. The Russians appear to be the most disappointed in the breakdown of the treaty because the Putin government has been very much concerned about irritating kinds of communication, irritating to the regime, that is, that have appeared on the internet. Information wants to be free is one of the first expressions of the internet. And even though that appears to be something less of an imperative than it first appears, it is a priority for the United States government. An interesting note on this from a worldview perspective. Both sides of the United States political divide are in basic agreement on this issue. In other words, Americans privilege the free flow of information to such an extent that neither Republicans nor Democrats wanted to see this treaty adopted in its current form. Something like this comes along and brings about that kind of political unity in the United States, that tells you something more than politics is at stake here. In the United States yesterday, the Census Bureau released a very important set of information indicating that the word minority, which has been so much a part of our political and moral discourse for the last several decades, is about to be superseded as it will no longer be totally relevant. In other words, if everyone's a minority, then the word loses all of its cogency and importance. That's exactly what the Census Bureau is projecting. It projects that within a matter of just a couple of decades, there will be no majority group in the United States in terms of culture or ethnicity, and that means that all of us will be minorities of one form or another. The new word that might have to be used is plurality. indicating that though a group does not represent a majority, it still is larger than any other. The group in terms of race and ethnicity that will continue to be a plurality is that of non-Hispanic whites. But it will be a minority in the United States population represented by that group, and it will be one minority alongside others. The fastest growing group in the United States are Hispanics. They're expected to double in population over the next several decades, but other demographic shifts are also of importance. And in terms of the Christian worldview, first of all, perhaps, for the importance of missiology, understanding the mission field that America will represent, but also representing the challenge of the kind of cultural diversity and the kind of cultural change that this will bring is a matter of worldview importance to us all. The U.S. will become a plurality nation where the non-Hispanic white population remains the largest single group, but no group is in the majority. That was said by Thomas Messenberg, the acting director of the Census Bureau. Now, the other data coming in from the 2010 census is painting a picture of a nation whose post-recession population is growing more slowly than anticipated. That in the report from Michael Cooper on this data published in the New York Times. A couple of other data points that are of importance to us. The elderly are expected to make up a growing share of the populace. Now, some numbers on that are, frankly, rather stark and surprising. For instance, in the year 2056, that's not that far out, just a little over 40 years from now, there will be more Americans 65 and over than 18 and younger. That is a very dangerous tipping point for any nation or population. It's about where Russia is right now, and there are demographic indications that Russia, as a nation, might well be below the point of sustainability in just a matter of two generations. As the census data indicate, this will mean that care for an aging population may well become a greater cultural priority than care for children, with geriatrics replacing pediatrics as a cultural concern. The share of the population that is between 18 and 64 is expected to decline to 56.9% in 2060. That's from the 62.7% that young Americans represent now. There are other changes in the population that are becoming more and more clear. By the year 2060, one in three Americans will be Hispanic. That reflects, by the way, a slowing of the Hispanic growth rate in the United States, with immigration from Mexico coming almost to a complete stop since 2006, and with birth rates among Hispanics falling faster than had been expected. Right now, that fertility rate is about 2.7. It's expected to fall in decades to come. All of this indicates that our mission field is changing. This is going to affect every single community and every local church in America. It's going to change the political complexion of the United States. Older voters vote differently than younger voters. Single voters vote differently than married voters. And voters of various ethnicities vote according to similar kinds of patterns. That means that America is going to change. And in a non-majority nation where everyone's a minority and some might be even a plurality, the reality is that this kind of change is going to force some very difficult decisions in the context of cultural change in the United States. Christians for the cause of the Great Commission are going to have to be very agile in thinking through these issues and very committed to using the information that comes to us for the cause of Christ in terms of reaching this nation. Are such issues alarming? Well, there's alarm in all kinds of things, but the most alarming thing in this data has to do with the aging of the population. And it's not the case that we would then have too many elderly people. It's that we would have too few younger people. That's something that cultural decisions aren't really going to affect. That's something that individual decisions will first affect, even if they are influenced by cultural trends. We will need more babies in years to come. Changing the entire logic of the population growth scare that had been very much a part of the culture since the 1960s and 70s. It turns out that the big problem is not going to be too many babies, but too few. And that in relatively short order. A very disturbing article recently appeared at Slate.com. It's by Emily Bazelon. It's entitled, "Will Churches Be Forced to Conduct Gay Weddings?" She says, "Not a chance." She then goes on to say, "That's just the scare tactic conservative groups use to frighten voters." Well, is she right? Let me say at this point that one of the most frustrating and disturbing aspects of this article is that it raises the question as to whether its author actually read what she wrote. Because at the end of the article, she actually makes the point opposite of the one she is so emphatically trying to make. She wants to assure us that there's no chance whatsoever that the United States government could do what the nation of Denmark recently did. This past June, Denmark's parliament, she writes, passed a law requiring churches to conduct gay marriage ceremonies. Priests can opt out, but if they do, the local bishop has to find a replacement to conduct the ceremony, end quote. A friend of hers, it turns out, sent her a link to that story saying that it's a warning of what could happen here. She disagrees. She says, quote, "This objection makes me apoplectic. We're not Denmark. We have a deep-rooted constitutional division between church and state and an equally deep-rooted constitutional protection of freedom of religion, which makes us different from any other country. And the history of how our courts and government have safeguarded those religious rights weigh definitively on the side of allowing churches to refuse to perform weddings for gay couples for so long as they choose. I'm not saying it's a good thing," she writes, "for churches to do that. I'm saying that the law balances the civil rights of gay people against the civil rights of religious groups. And in that contest, the churches and mosques and synagogues win," end quote. Now, she makes a very emphatic statement here. She says, basically, that only religious conservatives trying to scare voters are actually warning that such a thing could happen in the United States. She then goes through a very interesting history. She goes to the United States Supreme Court decision outlawing laws against intermarriage between races, and she points out that the United States government has intervened in religious institutions that have been found to cross this bar, that is, to practice racial discrimination. She points to the 1982 Supreme Court decision in which the Internal Revenue Service was supported by the Supreme Court against Bob Jones University. Bob Jones University was found to be guilty of racial discrimination, and as she writes, the court said that the government's interest in eradicating racial discrimination was fundamental, and that trumped Bob Jones's claim that the IRS was interfering with its exercise of freedom of religion, end quote. Now, remember, she says that it was irrational. It was a scare tactic. It was out of bounds to argue that such a thing, in terms of a government requirement of a church or religious institution to conduct a same-sex marriage, could take place in America. But then she goes on to cite a very case in which the kind of power, the coercive power of the government, was used in a different case, this one having to do with racial discrimination. She then writes, quote, "But the same rule most decidedly does not apply to religious groups that discriminate against women or gay people," end quote. She cites the case that discrimination on the basis of religious conviction in terms of hiring and other forms of discrimination having to do with women and with issues such as homosexuality, that at this point there is no government action against churches or religious institutions on that basis. She says it is insane to argue that that would ever take place. But then she goes on to cite that already some groups, such as, for instance, a Methodist campground at Ocean City in New Jersey, had their tax exemption revoked because they refused to allow same-sex marriages in part of their facility. She said this was a beachfront property, not a church, and 99% of the group's land, taken as a whole, retained its tax exemption, end quote. She goes on to say, once again, this just scare tactics used by conservatives trying to scare voters that leads persons to warn that that kind of coercive power or that kind of punitive action against churches or Christian institutions could take place in the United States. She then writes this, and this is where we have to pay very close attention. She writes, quote, "It's just wrong to spook voters about gay rights by arguing that gay people are coming for their churches. It's not going to happen, not just as a technical matter, but also a legal one. If that ever changes, it will be because we are as united about the pernicious nature of anti-gay discrimination as we are about racial discrimination. Or until no one wants to belong to a church that doesn't perform same-sex weddings any more than they'd want to be in a church that forbids interracial ceremonies. Maybe we should be there, but I don't need to tell you that we're not," end quote. In other words, she warns straightforwardly that it's insane, it's irrational, it's irresponsible, even unethical, she implies, to warn that the United States government could bring punitive action against churches or religious institutions for refusing to conduct or to recognize same-sex marriages. But then you'll notice she shifts to if that ever changes. Well, of course it's going to change. The great moral revolution that has brought about such a speedy shift in the population on issues of sexuality in general, homosexuality specifically, and same-sex marriage in particular in terms of most recent actions, she knows exactly where the cultural direction's going. Furthermore, she's already signaled that she thinks that's the direction it should go. And she says it could never happen here until, she says, if that ever changes. Well, never and if that ever changes are not compatible in the same argument. It is going to change. She knows it's going to change. And she wants it to change, given her own affirmation of gay rights as implicit in this article. If that ever changes, she says, it will be because we're as unified about the pernicious nature of anti-gay discrimination as we are about racial discrimination. On the issue of cultural and moral change, the reality is that a vast moral change is taking place around us. The eventual settlement in terms of this moral revolution is not yet clear, and convictional Christians still have much to add in terms of a voice in terms of dealing with these matters. But there is cultural change taking place. And it is in the case of this article that on the other side of such a moral revolution, similar to that which took place in terms of racial discrimination, the coercive power of the state necessarily follows. Emily Bazelon needs to read the end of her article. Then she needs to go back and revise the beginning of her article. She needs to take out all this suggestion that it's a scare tactic to warn that the coercive power of the state can be used against churches and Christian institutions. Because following the very logic of her own argument, the big question is not if, it is inevitably when. Once again, we reach the Christmas season, and this is the last daily installment of The Briefing until we pick up for the 2013 season, beginning on the 2nd. That's Wednesday, January the 2nd, and I hope you'll be back to listen then. And between then and now, I wish for you, your loved ones, your family, your church, a wonderful Christ-filled Christmas filled with all the glory of the season and the power of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. The mighty fact, that great, most profound fact that a human mind can know of the incarnation of the Lord Jesus Christ, is the hallmark of the Christmas season, and it is ample reason for celebration. And once again, I hope that you and your family have a wonderful Christmas and a most blessed New Year as well. As always, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on January the 2nd. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on the 2nd of January, Lord willing, for The Briefing.